This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, Michael Steele's back in the house for another conversation, and I'm so glad you could take a moment to join and be a part of this opportunity to listen, learn, and understand a little bit better what's going on out there. You know the drill, you know how I feel about downloads. So I always appreciate it when you do it because it makes me feel all yummy inside. And so continue to do that. That business out of the way, let's move to the important business of conversation that we're having today. This brother, you've seen him around. He's been out there making a good noise. Keith Boykin is a CNN political commentator, and there's a brother over here on MSNBC. I forgive him. It just is what it is. We got to be everywhere. That's what it's all about. But he's working over at CNN. He's also a New York Times bestselling author, a former White House aide to President Bill Clinton, teaches at the Institute of Research in African American Studies at Columbia University in New York. And he had previously taught here in Washington, D.C., at the American University, where my nieces and nephews attended. He's co-founder and the first board president of the National Black Justice Coalition. Co-host of the BET Network's talk show My Two Cents, starred on the Showtime reality television series American Candidate, was an associate producer of the film Dirty Laundry, and he has appeared on many other TV programs as well, including BET's Being Mary Jane. He's a graduate of Dartmouth College and Harvard Law School. That's, just so you know, Keith, that's how I say Harvard all the time. It's just, Harvard. Right. I went to Georgetown. So. We just up in the street. But the key thing out of all of that is he is a Lambda Literary Award-winning author of four books, and his most recent book, which brings him by the podcast this time, is Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. It's out now. Highly recommend you get it because this brother touches on some heartbeats that have been a part of my conversations nationally about race in this country. And so gives me a real special pleasure to welcome you, number one, but to let you know how much I appreciate the strong message that you bring in this book, Race Against Time. So welcome, bro.
Thank you. What an introduction. You went way, way back in time for that one. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I think it's important for people to kind of get a feel for the origin. Because a lot of times, you know, we catch people sometimes out of context. They got a new book and it's on this, and they don't understand how it relates back to other things that have moved and shaped their lives. So I like to spend a little bit more time filling that out for listeners so that they understand, number one, you're not some fly by night. You're an award-winning author. You are someone who speaks nationally. You've been in politics in the White House. So when you talk about these things, people should listen, you know, because it matters. So let's just jump into Race Against Time. You, you bring this story out about and I don't know if people really kind of get it's not just a race against time. In other words, like you're racing against time, but it's also race, Black folks, people of color against time itself. So, and it's how I kind of got into the book. Tell us where you wanted to go with this and what you want people to really kind of hold on to as you take them through your narrative in Race Against Time. Mm.
Thank you. That's a very perceptive question. You know, the book title is actually a double entendre, but I don't think everybody quite understood that. Mm-hmm. But apparently did. But you actually gave me sort of a new interpretation of it, so it might be a triple entendre. But what I meant by it is that it seems like America right now is engulfed in a cold civil war, and part of that is because of the fact that a lot of people in conservative elements of white America have begun what I call a race against time to stop the darkening of America, to stop the changing of America. And you see that reflected in the demographic changes taking place. The white Christian population is no longer the majority in this country. We had a Census Bureau report came out recently that said the white population is actually decreasing for the first time in history. There was another important census report that came out in March of 2015, a few months before Donald Trump announced his campaign. And that one predicted that by 2044, the white population would no longer be the majority.
That's right.
So all these different data points are scary to a lot of people. You add that to what's taking place in terms of the political ramifications, political changes, and you see this. You see we had a Black president for 8 years. We see we have a Black woman who's now a vice president. We see that we had a woman who ran for president and got more votes than the white man who actually won the presidency.
Right.
We see that we have marriage equality in all 50 states. We see now that we have a Latino population that's growing so rapidly that in the next 3 decades, 4 to 5 states may have a Hispanic majority. Mm-hmm. We see that the Asian American population is growing rapidly. So all these things are changing, and it's encouraging this sort of race against time. This is part of the reason why when Donald Trump started his political career, he started it essentially in 1989 with his attack on the Central Park Five.
Right.
He runs as a candidate in the Reform Party ticket in 2000. He doesn't succeed there, but his campaign is focused on trade. That's in immigration. Those are his two big consistent issues throughout his career. Then in 2011, he begins his 5.5-year attack on Barack Obama's birth certificate. Again, this is part of this whole racial-driven campaign. In 2014, when the Ebola crisis hits West Africa, Trump surfaces again and calls for Obama to resign because of it. Mind you, there are only a handful of people in this country who were affected by it. Right. But Trump was calling for Obama to resign because fewer than a dozen people in America had Ebola. And here we have a crisis in our country now with 700,000 people dead. Nobody ever said that, well, Trump never said that he should have resigned for that. But then when his campaign actually starts, what's the first thing he does? He attacks Mexicans. He says, yeah, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. And then when his campaign starts to get a rise, what's the next thing he does? He starts attacking Muslims. All of this is this race against time, this effort to stop the demographic changes in our country, to appeal to that base of people who are afraid of that change, and ultimately leads to the insurrection on January 6th. It ultimately is just this fear that's going on at the populist level, the public level, the level of American people. Mm-hmm. And it's escalated to the level of the political class, where we have hundreds of different state legislative bills that have been introduced to restrict the voting rights, or gerrymandering going on in state after state, in places like Texas, the most extreme we see. And there are mechanisms in place to perpetuate a particular group of people to maintain their power, while the changing America makes their power more and more threatened.
Yeah, yeah, you touched on a number of things. One in particular that has been a reality check for me that I've tried to share with with audiences that I've spoken to, and that is along that demographic line shift away from a majority white Christian America, which, you know, a lot of white folks want to tie back to their European origins and, you know, the Europeanization of America, if you will. They, you know, want to reanimate that spirit, even though, as I'd like to point out to them, that's what the founders were trying to get away from. they were like, nah, we time out. We don't want to do that. But in Race Against Time, there were many passages, but what I want to focus on that really trips into what you just said, in the chapter Till Victory Is Won, you note, quote, if there's one thing I've learned as a Black man in America, and it's something I've learned too over a long life, it is that time does not heal all wounds. I've seen how the unhealed wounds of slavery, segregation, racism, and white supremacy still continue to divide our country. And I know that this pattern will persist unless we change. It is for this reason that Dr. King warned that, quote, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. King cautioned us in 1963 to avoid the, quote, strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all of this, end quote. And that, for me, really kind of summarizes this process that you described, that it is neutral. It is what it is. You know, no one's dictating, oh, there will be more Hispanics than there are white or more whites than there are Asians. No one's dictating that. Time is agnostic. It's what we do as a culture, as a community, as a society, that either constructively or destructively play in that, act in that, move in that. The reality of it is that America is browning by natural occurrence. It just is. What do you think accounts for that destructive response to that? Is it just out of the fear that, oh, they're about to become the new majority? Or is there something else there that we are clued in on? How do you see that race against time in that regard?
That's a good question. In terms of what is the root cause of it, it's a difficult question for me to answer because I'm not white. Right. And so I can only speculate about this, but I perceive this to be a sense of fear of the loss of status. I talk about this a lot in the book in the context of, you know, there was an old discussion. Remember, I think it was George Lakoff's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And there's this common perception, I think, in the political class that white working class voters are actually voting against their economic interest by voting for Donald Trump or Republican candidates. And I don't believe that. I think that they actually believe they're voting for their economic interest. And part of the reason why I believe that is because there is a property right in whiteness in our country, which is a language I take from one of my former professors. But there is a value in just being white in this country. I know that it seems paradoxical for some white people who don't have access to economic means to think that they have some sort of economic benefit over Black people. But I also know that if I walk outside of my apartment here in Harlem and I raised my hand on the corner to get a taxi cab, that the taxi driver is less likely to pick me up than to pick up a white person.
Right.
They don't know anything about my income or my profession.
Right, exactly.
My educational background. They just see me. And so I think that sometimes people understate the significance of that benefit for white Americans in society. And that deprivation of that privilege it seems devastating for a lot of people. You know, there's an old saying that when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. Yes. And there's a parallel statement that white America should be grateful that Black Americans don't seek revenge, but only equality. And the truth is that I think a lot of white Americans, and I say the truth in quotes because, again, I don't speak for white Americans, don't know, but I think the truth is that a lot of white Americans are afraid of this sort of idea that they will find themselves in a position of being subordinate to the interest of Black and brown people, and that they won't be respected, their interests won't be valued if Black people have more power, brown people have more power, and they won't have the sense of privilege, which gives them some sort of economic benefit. So there's a complicating set of factors involved in this. And, I think at the core, it's hard to say this for people here, but I think it's all really related to the issue of race, but it's something people don't really like to talk about.
Is this what animates the, as you term it? And I really appreciate that, particularly given some of the other things that that are being reported and that I'm reading most recently, a wonderfully done opinion piece in the Washington Post by Robert Kagan, and where he talks about our constitutional crisis is already here. You talk about we are right now in a cold civil war. So, you know, it's and so giving context for those who are listening, it is like the Cold War of old, where they're not you know, rockets being fired between Russia and the United States, but there's a lot of building up of ammunition, right, and a lot of breastfeeding and a lot of ugly noise. That is what we're seeing play out in reaction to the browning of this country. By a lot of folks, particularly those who I reject somewhat, I think, along the lines of what you were saying, this idea that, oh, this, you know, this is, you know, a reaction of poor white people. No, this is a reaction of middle class white folks, because in their estimation, they're looking at the American dream as they've defined it. Is shrinking away from them. So there is that reaction. And it really does play into this sense of patriarchy and the privilege that comes with that. And how do you see that setting up? I mean, based on what you just said, sort of animating this civil war, this cold civil war. And do you think that leads to something more than just a cold civil war? Because I've actually had a number of folks white folks that I've talked to who've looked me in the eye and said, oh, there's a civil war coming. It's coming. There are people and actively want it to happen. And not only is that chilling to hear, but it is a truth, I think, that, yeah, we may have to confront if January 6th means anything.
Well, if you look at history, the Civil War was decades in preparation. It didn't just happen in 1861. There were a series of steps along the way where our leaders made compromises to prevent that from happening, going all the way back to the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. the Constitution, the Compromise of 1820, the Missouri Compromise, Compromise of 1850, the Kansas-Nebraska Act. All those steps are designed to sort of ameliorate the crisis that was going on in our country, knowing that we had slave states and free states and trying to figure out how to make this union survive. And it just collapsed when Lincoln was elected, in spite of the fact that Lincoln expressly stated that he had no intention of dismantling slavery. But ultimately, he was forced to do so in order to preserve the union. So I think that, yes, I think we are on a dangerous trajectory that could lead to an actual civil war. And I think there are some people who want that to happen. And those are the people who are pushing this most dangerous agenda. And they're pushing the Republican Party, I think, to embrace not a civil war, but to embrace some of these elements of the party who the party has traditionally not embraced. And that's what's so you know more about this than I do, but that's what's so tragic. You know, the Republican Party's evolution over the course of the past 50, 60 years is just one that reflects the fact that a lot of the people who Donald Trump appealed to in 2016 and 2020 were people who were below the surface before. They weren't allowed the same sort of audience. And now they've been welcomed into the fold, into the mainstream. And I think that what's happened is that there's been a monster created that I don't even think the Republican Party can control. We saw this when Donald Trump gave that speech recently and mentioned the fact that he had been vaccinated.
Well, Lindsey Graham, just this past week.
Exactly.
Graham said, I really think y'all should get the vaccine. Boo!
Exactly. Exactly. Like,
okay, well, you don't have to. But I love the way you put that, because I say this all the time in reference to my party. And I can say it because I'm still a member of this party and will be for as long as I can, because I know it pisses them off. But the fact of the matter is that they have created this sort of Frankensteinish monster. And the expectation was, and we know this going back to the leadership at the time, whether it was Paul Ryan and John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, and others on the Hill, thinking that they could control Donald Trump. Oh, that's all right. When he gets to Washington, we'll control him. You know, we'll set the agenda, because we know Washington and we know. And Trump was like, okay, sure, we'll do that. And it's like that Frankenstein monster where the expectation of the good Dr. Frankenstein is that the villagers, you know, are going to come after them with their pitchforks and their torches, and they're going to eventually kill the monster. You know, the leadership is going to control this monster. And when Dr. Frankenstein realizes, as the leadership, he can no longer do that, looking to the villagers to do that. But what did he find instead? Instead of the villagers coming with their pitchforks and torches to kill the monster, they're with the monster. And they're storming the castle on behalf of the monster. And that's the new reality. And it speaks a great deal to that politics. You know, it's great that you brought that up, because I was going to move into that. You talk about accountability Race Against Time. And you note, quote, the long history of outright racism in the Democratic Party from 1828 to 1964, and in the Republican Party from 1964 to the present, should remind us that no party can be fully trusted forever. Parties are not static institutions that are resistant to outside forces. They comprise humans. And in this country, those humans have repeatedly shown themselves willing to sacrifice the persistent demands of Black people for justice, to pursue the predictable pleas of white people for peace. Mm. And we hear that. We saw it with Black Lives Matter. You know, we see it whenever the Black community becomes animated and agitated about the injustice that they experience. Then you hear cries for law and order. You hear cries for, you know, why can't they just peacefully protest? Mm. Right? Nah, bitch, we didn't run up on Capitol Hill and storm the Capitol and break glass and kill cops and injured people. All we did was march down the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Right.
So what is that? What is behind that? What animates that kind of silliness and lack of seriousness in addressing the real genuine concerns of communities of color that are tied into these offenses?
Hmm. There's so much to unpack there. Where to begin? Well, you know, I'm glad you quoted that part about the parties, because I'm a lifelong Democrat and you're a lifelong Republican, but I don't trust either of these political parties to do the right thing.
Right.
And part of the reason why I wrote a chapter on accountability is for Black people to remember that we have to hold all of our leaders accountable, regardless of whether they're Black or white, Democrat or Republican. And oftentimes I think what happens is that we get sort of beholden to a team, and we choose our sort of political tribalism over the interest of our own community.
And if I could real quick, that's where you note in the book, woke supremacy is as bad as white supremacy. You make that declarative and very clear.
No, I don't, that's Tim Scott saying that.
I'm sorry. That's what I meant to say. Yeah, Tim Scott makes that comparison, and you respond to that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know that there is such a thing as woke supremacy, first of all. I think Jonathan Capehart wrote a piece about this in the Washington Post.
Right.
But I don't think that that is a thing that exists. I think what people who are advocating for social justice are suggesting is that we have to be much more conscious about all the different things that we've been doing for hundreds of years and to interrogate why those things have led to the outcomes that we have right now. Why is it that white men are 29% of the population in this country, but 98% of our presidents in the United States? Why is it that women are the majority of the population in our country, but we've never had a woman president? This doesn't just happen by accident. It's not because white men are the only qualified people who can be president or be leaders in our country. It's because we have a social structure that's invested in perpetuating this. And so it's our responsibility to question that and figure out how we can challenge that. But historically speaking, both parties have failed to do this.
Right.
And, you know, there have been times when the Republican Party from 1865 to 1877, the Reconstruction period, was on it. And then it drifted away to a certain extent. The Democratic Party from time to time was on it, and then it drifted away from time to time. And so if you look back historically, you can find examples of presidents from both parties, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, even Dwight Eisenhower, you know, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton, whomever you pick, you can find problematic issues with both parties from both presidents and who failed to sort of address issues of racial concern, including Barack Obama, somebody who I supported and voted for twice, and Bill Clinton, for whom I worked. So where does this lead us? That we have this situation now where people have, what I think white people need to understand is that white America will never truly be able to feel safe until Black Americans feel a sense of justice. So this is what I mean, what I think people mean when they say no justice, no peace. The idea is that you can't just pass a law every now and then or take some sort of cosmetic step every now and then to sort of satisfy a group of people who are upset. It doesn't deal with the underlying causes. And until Black people and brown people start feeling a sense of justice, a sense of equality in this country, white America is going to continue to still feel unsafe. That's why we're going to have more people going out and buying not just one gun, but tons of guns and protect themselves. We're going to invest more and more in policing and law enforcement. We're going to build more prisons because we don't want to deal with the underlying causes of the social inequity in our society. And that I'm suggesting, I don't know anybody in the world who wouldn't feel better knowing that a crime didn't happen, as opposed to having somebody come in and respond afterwards and go arrest those people. So if we want to prevent crime, we know how to do that. We know we need to invest in communities. We know we need to invest in jobs and healthcare and education and schools and affordable housing. We know we need to have clean environments and safe drinking water. We know we need to have an equitable criminal justice system that doesn't just target one group of people, but treats everyone fairly. If we have those things, we won't have to have people arming themselves to the teeth. We won't have to be so afraid. White America won't have to be so afraid of Black people because they'll know that Black people don't feel aren't threatening to them.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. And that's where I was trying to get to it. And I was got excited and quoted Tim Scott's quote as yours, which is what I wasn't trying to do that. Because that's where Scott gets into that whole sort of woke comparison. Now, look, I get what that is. That's a talking point inside the GOP. When Tim Scott goes out and says that, that's because they've had a conversation with the boys in the room, and the boys in the room have said to him, "Tom, we need you to go out and say that." How do I know that? Because that shit was what they tried to do with me, and I never played along, which is why, well, you know how that story turns out. But it does go to this question of in what ways do have those well-intentioned sort of progressive policies around these issues of criminal justice and voting rights and economic disparity and health disparities failed to resolve that long-term tension that exists, those long-term racial tensions and inequalities that still persist. And it kind of, in one sense, for me, goes to the point you're making broadly about the political parties. At the end of the day, having led parties at all levels, led the party at all levels, and certainly spent a lot of time with former chairmen like Ed Rendell and Tim Kaine, who are friends, and we've talked about some of these things, there is a water's edge for politics. It will only go but so far, because to go where it really should go means that a whole lot of that the political capital that they've been stockpiling, they've got to spend in ways they don't want to spend on things they don't want to spend it on. And so as a consequence, Keith, you find a lot of those things that you are talking about don't get addressed. And I give you right now the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. How the hell is that not passed at this point? Just how damn important is it to Democrats? All right, just keep it in the political context versus all Americans, for heaven's sakes. But you guys, not you, meaning you as a Democrat, but Democrats have the White House, the House, the Senate. Can you show me some political moxie and just pass the damn thing and let the good trouble fall where it may? I mean, that's where, and Black folks look at that and they go, well, okay, all right, I guess we'll just wait.
Well, if you pass the collection plate, I'll chip in some dollars for that one, because you were preaching there. This is the point I've been making for a long time. I mean, there's two parts to this. First of all, the part about activism, politics. Politics will only go so far, and politicians are inherently, I think, cautious creatures who are not inclined to take big risks, which is the reason why you need people. Like the reason why we needed a Dr. King out there. Right. In order to push a JFK or an LBJ, because they weren't going to do it on their own. They needed those activists out there to push them. Now, in terms of where we are right now, it's...
Brother had to take a sigh.
Yeah. I wrote a piece about this in the Washington Post a few weeks ago, where I talked about this too. I think the Republican Party has an opportunity here, but I don't think they're going to take advantage of it. And this is why. I think that we now have, as you said, Democrats in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, and yet we can't, not only can we not pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we also haven't been able to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act or the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act. Those are three pieces of legislation that are specifically designed to help Black people. And Black people are the most loyal constituency of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party won't deliver. And they've fallen back on this excuse about the filibuster, and we can't get the filibuster, so we can't get anything. Come on. I mean, you're in charge. People don't want to hear excuses. They want results. If you can get a $3.5 trillion stimulus plan passed, if you can get all these other infrastructure bills and budget bills that you're talking about passed, there's no reason why we can't prioritize the concerns of African Americans, the most loyal constituency of your party. But they expect that Black people are just going to continue to show up and vote each time. And I argue in my post piece that Black people may not show up at some point. I think what we're seeing right now is that the Republican Party, the Democratic Party today is where the Republican Party was 100 years ago. 100 years ago in 1921, Black voters had been voting overwhelmingly for the Republican Party for a half a century. Mm-hmm. And there was no sign of any change. And all of a sudden that changed a decade later. And nobody right now thinks that Black people are going to abandon the Democratic Party. But that could change too if the Republican Party is smart enough to take advantage of this opportunity, because the Democratic Party isn't delivering. So I think it's incumbent upon the Democrats to do something. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris can't just sit there and expect Black people are going to show up to vote in 2022 or 2024 if there are no deliverables that they can bring to the table. And that's the real challenge. I don't know if you hear the construction noise outside my window.
No, you're good. You're good. Yeah, no, you're good. You probably hear it, but it's not coming through. Okay. So why don't we do this? Because you just opened the door to the heart of what I wanted to talk about, because Race Against Time for me is all about the next thing we're going to talk about. And so hang in there with us, folks. We're going to take a quick break, having incredibly insightful and good conversation with Keith Boykin, the author of the book that's out now, Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. Got to check it out. We'll be back right after this.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody. Michael Steele here. We are in the throes of a great conversation with Keith Boykin. He is a CNN political commentator, New York Times bestselling author, and the author of the latest book, Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. Race Against Time, Keith, sort of sets out a number of important narratives about this, the political, economic, social evolution, the things that sort of that drive the Black agenda, the Black narrative, how white folks deal with that. And in the book, you touch on something that for me is, well, you don't just touch on it, you just kind of put your foot right into it, which is what I love. Something that to me at the end of the day is the most essential thing. As much as you have white folks wringing their hands about, oh, our numbers are shrinking. Oh, by 2044, we'll be a minority. Oh my God. Here's the rub. Yeah, you may have a majority combo of Black, Hispanic, and Asian Americans outnumbering the white Christian ethos, right? Or population. But we ain't controlling Wall Street. We are not controlling nation's politics. We are not going to have the majority of governors and United States senators. We won't control the money, and we won't control the power. I can tell you for a fact, those are the two things that pissed people off when I was RNC chairman, because I was using both of those, especially the money piece. When I go in the door my first week, couple of weeks, and I cancel $8, $10, $12 million of contracts that was supposed to go to a group of white boys on K Street, oh yeah, you piss off some folks.
I bet.
When you're controlling the money and the power, guess what? Your color don't matter. It's just, okay, who's controlling the money and the power? Hmm. And we can put it in that context now because white folks got that. At the end of the day, all that whining and gnashing of teeth for me is just kind of a facade, because I don't think it, when it's all shakes out, that when you get to 2045, you're going to wake up and the top CEOs of Fortune 50 companies are going to be all Black.
Right.
So, yeah, that's not gonna happen. Yeah. So what does that mean? When you look at this race against time, what does that mean? And because that to me is the piece. You got to work on the money and the power piece. And it really kind of relates back to what we were just talking about in terms of how the politics, instead of advancing those agendas that will actually put you on the track to amass the power and create the wealth, are actually not designed to do that. Because DC could be a state tomorrow if there everybody wanted it to be, right? But guess what? All of a sudden now you're gonna add two black senators. Well, not so much now because DC ain't Chocolate City anymore. Right.
It's more, but two Democratic senators.
It's more like a mocha. So right. You know. So, but that's power for the Democratic Party. That's not necessarily power for black folks. So right. I think we need to be clear about that. Because there is a big difference. And it goes to what you were saying. Yeah, Democrats can count on black folks, but there comes a point where black folks go, well, we no longer see ourselves reflected in the power agenda. So how do you think that plays out?
Good questions. I remember an experience in November 2008, when I was covering the election night for CNBC, the business network I used to work for. And I remember we were on air on set at 10:45, and we got the message in our earpiece that they were about to call the election at 11 o'clock for Barack Obama. And it was a emotional moment for me. I went to law school with President Obama, and it was just the idea that America was about to elect its first black president. And then when they made the call, it still impacted me. And after we went to commercial break, after we'd finished covering that segment, I seem to be the only one who seemed to be affected by it. Everyone else just continued on in their normal conversations. And it occurred to me that it for the people who are white and in power, it wasn't a threat to them that Barack Obama was going to be elected. I mean, because even if you were the president of the United States, that they were still going to be powerful. They were still going to have their money. Nothing he could possibly do was going to dismantle the systemic advantages that had already been set up to help them out. And so it didn't threaten them in the same way that it threatened other people, but it didn't threaten them at all. And it didn't even empower them necessarily in the way that it empowered me. So it was just this eye-opening experience of how different people can perceive the same event in a completely different way. But part of the answer to the power question is, this is not the only solution. It's not necessarily a solution I'm recommending. But one idea that has been raised, I mentioned in the book, is Charles Blow's idea in The Devil You Know. I don't know if you spoke to him on your podcast or not yet, but Charles talks about sort of reverse migration, encouraging black people from the North to move to the South, to a particular set of Southern states where they can actually elect black senators and black governors and others and have sort of a regional power base to have influence in the country. And I think it's a compelling and persuasive argument, although I think it's kind of difficult to sort of get people to do that.
Because grandma left the South.
Right, exactly.
I don't think she wants me to go back.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess if you're a retiree, you may be more inclined to go back for the weather or something.
Right, but there's value to that. Well, and I'll tell you why there's a lot of value to that, because what we see happening in Republican politics and Democratic politics is based on migration. And when people migrate, guess what? They bring their politics with them. So if you look at the capital region, you know, the DMV, you look at how, you know, at one point it was, you know, Prince George's County, Maryland, where I live, Baltimore City, Montgomery County. That was the black political power base anchor in the state of Maryland and actually kind of, sort of set the pattern, if you will. And why do I say that? Because what has happened in the once very, very red state of Virginia, which is now in a very, very blue state, black folks from Prince George's County, Montgomery County, and DC moved where? Into Northern Virginia, when Northern Virginia began its open expanse. And guess what? Now Northern Virginia has become like those three jurisdictions because of the migration of people of color into Northern Virginia, especially Asian Americans, for example, along with African Americans and Hispanics. So you're absolutely right. And why is that important? Because you see the trend line. So you go from, you see this trend line going from the South, so North Carolina into South Carolina. Now it's hit Georgia.
Right.
So there's a lot of validity to the points you're making about this migration and the changing of the political dynamics through demographics.
Although I have to say, I think the trend line as it went south kind of skipped over South Carolina. It doesn't look like it made it there.
Well, no, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But South Carolina, irrespective of what happened in the last election, I think is still in that transitional spot. There were a lot of factors and dynamics that at the end of that campaign, that the Graham campaign, that changed elements there, and that was largely among black folks, to be honest. And you know what did it? Well, it's no secret. When you start to defund the police narrative, the irony is, I guess it's ironic only because people think, black folks want that. The irony is they don't. It's not been a part of the system. So when you start to say, wait, but hold up. When I call the police, you mean they ain't coming? And so so you had these sort of elements that, but I would contend that, you'll look at places like South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Louisiana, et cetera. Their point is they're impacted by those demographic shifts. And there is a lot of validity if you see a migration of young African Americans back into the South, out of the big cities of New York and DC and places like that. You're right. I mean, I think you can see a real change in the politics potentially at some point.
Well, yeah, that's right. And I think the issue that you were getting at in your primary question is about power and equality and how do we get to that point. And I think part of the answer is what I suggest in the last part of my book, which is we have to shift our goalpost that we have, I think, over the course of much of my lifetime, focused only on harm reduction. How do we reduce harm to Black people? But I don't think that's enough to get us to a point of equality. I had a conversation last night with former Cambridge Mayor Ken Reeves in a bookstore signing in Boston about reparations. And I was saying that I support reparations, but I don't think that's enough either. And what I mean is that I don't think that we can assume that any one particular step is going to achieve equality for Black people, and that this has to be sort of a long-standing goal for America. And I don't think we have to be beholden to one tool to get us there. The truth is that we have racial disparities that are long-standing in this country. The unemployment rate for Black people is nearly twice the unemployment rate for white people. We were disproportionately affected by the COVID pandemic, just like we are with all health issues. We don't have the same access to schooling. We have more college debt. We don't have the same opportunities for housing. The average, we were talking about this last night, the average Black household income, or the median household income in Boston for Black people was $8. Yeah. Not 800 or 8,000, but $8 compared to several hundred thousand for white people in Boston. And so my framework is throw out all the sort of discussion we have in the policy arena about this law, this policy or that policy. Let's focus on outcomes. How do we get to that outcome? I don't really care if you're Republican or Democrat or progressive or conservative or moderate. What will get us to the outcome where Black and white people are relatively equal in this country? And until we reach that goal, then all this harm reduction discussion is going to just be nibbling at the edges instead of dealing with the fundamental problem.
How do you address this idea that's prevalent out there now? I don't think it's realistic, but that's just me. I don't want to shade your answer before you give it, of a colorblind society.
Yeah, people love to quote that passage from Dr. King. But they forget everything else, Dr. King.
Right, exactly.
So, I think colorblindness is not realistic. Not realistic for a country as diverse as ours is, nor do I think it should be a goal, to be honest. I don't think the problem is that people isn't that people see color. The problem is that people differentiate in a negative way toward a particular color. Mm-hmm. And so we want to see color. We want to see the differences and diversity of people from different backgrounds and different ethnicities and nationalities. That's part of what makes America rich.
Right.
I like to think of America as a salad bowl instead of the melting pot, where we have all these different elements. So if you don't have the tomatoes and the lettuce and the croutons and the onions and
right.
whatever else you put in, it's not the same salad.
Right.
And each of those elements adds something to it. And I don't want to ignore all those things and make one bland, homogenous society. I want us to have a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multicultural society where all of us have opportunities and everyone can benefit from that.
The book is just, I think it's an important and very good read. Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. The author is Keith Boykin. CNN commentator, New York Times bestselling author. I really appreciate you taking some time to sort of break down your thinking in this space and sharing the work you've written here. I highly recommend it to folks because we really need to come to a better understanding of how we confront and deal with these realities and not just rely on the, oh, gee, we're going to be the majority soon, or damn it, they're going to be the majority soon. And actually get beyond that to understand what the race against time is all about.
Can I just say one more thing real quickly?
Sure, absolutely.
I was thinking you're going to mention this, but you didn't, so I'll mention it.
No, please, yeah.
Is that one of the points I make in the book that's kind of controversial, I think, for some people, is that I say that there should be more Black people should join the Republican Party.
I was gonna get into that, but I felt that you touched on it, but let's go a little deep. So let's go into that, because you actually do say, Black people should join the Republican Party. Tell me why.
And it seems counterintuitive because I'm not a Republican for me to say this, but. I think that neither party could or can or should have a hold over African Americans. And so what we need to do is we need to be invested in both the major political parties and every political party. But the problem is, I think I point out in the book, that many of the Black people who have joined the Republican Party have been more invested in preaching the Republican Party or promoting the Republican Party to Black people, rather than promoting Black interests to the Republican Party.
Hello. So
I'm suggesting that Black people who join the Republican Party should be there, not just to become talking heads and parrot the GOP talking points to sell Black people, but to help Republicans understand why it's in their interest to reach out to Black people. And that's the core difference. And so I encourage people to do it for that reason alone, so that we actually have a foot and influence in both political parties, not just in one political party.
I could not agree with you more, but here's the rub.
Yeah. Right.
If you do not want a thing, then you do not have that thing. So if you it's one thing to say, we want Blacks to join the Republican Party. It's another thing to say, to believe and to want Blacks to join the Republican Party on their terms, not yeah. on your terms. So the expectation that mm-hmm. Black folks join the party and start spewing white shit, that does not work. It's not in our interest to do that. We're right. not going to sublimate our concerns, our justice issues and other issues to a broader white vision of America, which is what's happening inside the party. I know this firsthand. I've had this battle for the 45 years I've been in it. I ran the party in one of the first meetings I had with the national leadership of state chairman and national committee of men and women. Was do not get all jacked up because a Black man is sitting here as chairman. I'm not your Pied Piper. Mm-hmm.
because the work for growing and building what you're saying happens at the county level. And that's where state chairmen assert their leadership. And that's where local parties elect people who represent those broad issues that Reagan talked about when we once admired Reagan, or that, you know, Bush would put out in his compassionate conservatism that appreciated the personal struggles of families and individuals, right?
So do you think
there's no interest to do that?
Do you think the Republican Party is irredeemable?
In this iteration, with this infection of Trumpism, absolutely.
Then why are you still a Republican?
I want to be able to show that there is a space that we can move into. All right. So what that means for me is I don't know if we'll be able to recapture what you're talking about, what I'm talking about inside this structure. But it's like the torch, it's like the flame. You got to keep it burning. All right. Even though this is not the space that wants to see that flame, that embraces the power and energy from that, you don't snuff it out. Because the easiest thing to do is, because once you step outside the party, as a lot of my friends have done, then you're easily dismissed. It's easily to discount when you make the claims and post the indictments against what's happening inside the party. They go, oh, you're an anti-Trumper, you're a never-Trumper, you're a rhino, you're this. It's harder to do that I had this battle a few weeks ago with someone who was like, oh, you're a rhino. And I looked at him and said, how long have you been a Republican? And they wouldn't answer the question because they knew exactly what I was going to say, where I was going. I knew they'd been a Republican for a hot minute. I said, I've been a Republican for 45 years. I've carried this war. I've been in this fight. I know what this is about. And the fact that I'm still here says more about me being a Republican than you. Because you're here because you embrace an ideology that is not anchored in anything this party's ever stood for. It is anchored in one person and one person only. And this idea of conservatism, you are in this iteration, you're only considered a conservative if you support Trump because they think Trump is conservative, but Trump ain't a conservative. Right. Trump just endorsed Stacey Abrams, for heaven's sakes, over the sitting Republican governor of Georgia.
Trump has no political beliefs, in my opinion.
Right, he has no political beliefs. So anyone who's following someone who has no political beliefs, what are you following? That's why I hold the torch up and say, okay, when y'all get your head out your asses and you're actually looking for real light, here it is. These things, you know? And so that for me is a big compelling part of it. It's the easiest thing to walk away, but it's also the hardest thing to do. Hmm. And it's easy if you do so in anger and frustration. It's harder when you're there because of love and appreciation. And, you know, the debates I used to have with my Democratic friends, for example, on big policy. I mean, my buddy Rick Unger and I had these knockdown drag out fights on healthcare, because I philosophically have a different view of the role in government when it comes to healthcare. That's good. That's healthy for the country. That's a healthy conversation to have. But we now have conversations that revolve around the fact that if you don't support the big lie, if you don't support the narrative that there was fraud in this election, if you don't support the narrative that critical race theory, which is not, that there's not a high school, elementary school in this country that has a clue of what it is because it's never taught there. There are universities that don't teach it because it's that high level, right? It's law school stuff, right? But you dumb it down to the point where you think your sixth grader is now being taught critical race theory. If you don't buy into those narratives, then you're not a conservative, you're not a Republican. That for me is just bullshit. And so I keep the flame, you know, burning on what Republicanism is, not just what it was. That's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican. it's not tied so much to the Republican Party as much as it's tied to the founder of the party and the men and women, both Black and white, who played a significant role in trying to establish a true line for freed slaves. I mean, you made the point earlier, Keith, this was our political home. This is where Black folks started. We were voting Republican 90-10, just like we vote Democrat 90-10 today, right? And we can almost see where this, you know, the switch was flipped on it. So it's a, for me, it's a very, it's personal, it's political, it's all this stuff. I did appreciate your point in the book. I thought we touched on it. We didn't go as deep as we probably could have when we were talking about Blacks and Republicanism and Tim Scott and that a little bit earlier. But that really is for me, I'm not an advocate for Blacks to join the party right now, because I don't know how to tell them that their ancestors aren't from shithole countries. Hmm.
Very interesting. I'm glad you shared that with me, because it's odd that I'm the one telling people that Black people they should consider joining the party. You're telling them not to. But
what I'm saying is, you know, hold that pressure, because I agree with you. I've always been an advocate for being in both parties. I think we have not leveraged our power at all, not well, but not at all. And we have gotten suckered in enough times, I think, at this point, that we are politically mature enough to know how to leverage and wait. And I think just rushing into the arms of Republicans right now, and that's what upset me so much in the last election, when, you know, the Trumpers are running around boasting about a platinum plan. I'm like, okay, first off, why the hell did you call it a platinum plan? Why couldn't you call it, you know, economic prosperity, legacy wealth for the African-American community? Oh, no, you had to come up with the platinum plan, because we wouldn't otherwise be interested if it wasn't platinum, gold, or silver. I mean, it's just little stuff like that that tells me you ain't serious. You don't get to come up in my house and in my community and talk to people and tell them, well, Black unemployment is the lowest it's ever been, therefore you should vote for Donald Trump. Bitch, you need to show me more than that. You know, it's not just this idea that I can do, and it's typically how, and it's something I fought inside the party, where everybody just wanted to do the one-off. It's like holding a cocktail party and taking a photo with a Black person around your arm and going, gee, look, you know, and I'm not moved by that, because I've been in that room enough times and I know they're not serious, because if you were serious, you would never have let the Voting Rights Act sit in the desk drawer of the Senate Majority Leader when we had the majority. If you were serious when Donald Trump said that there were fine people on both sides, you would have stood up and said, no, they're not. They're racist asses out there who want to kill Jews and Blacks. They're not fine people. They're not on our side. You wouldn't embrace the Proud Boys. You wouldn't say my ancestors are from shithole countries. Even if you think yours are, that's on you, but you don't get to say that about mine, right? So I think there are too many times where we could assert, and I look right now, even on the criminal justice front, all of the dancing and shenanigans, you know, with Scott and Corey, and they kill it over what? Over police accountability, holding police accountable for the things that they do in the community. We just could not go that far. We just could not can't.
I don't think it was ever going to happen anyway.
No, neither did I.
It would have been something else if not that. There was always going to be an excuse to not pass that. And they definitely didn't want to give Biden the opportunity to get that victory. So anyway, no. I know we're beyond your time.
Is great, man. I love it. Like I said, this is what I love that you went there and appreciate your opening up this part of the conversation a little bit more in depth and sort of now you kind of see. Look, I long for a day where a Republican Party that I grew up and knew that attracted a young African-American kid out of DC at 17 around values and family and community and country, responsibility, not just personal responsibility, but national responsibility. Yeah, that party, I will go into neighborhoods from Harlem to Watts to talk about why this is of value. But what we have right now, I don't see the value for us. And that saddens me a lot. But I appreciate your encouraging people to look at it.
Good luck. All right. Thank you.
But it's one of the great, it's the great irony of our politics, right?
Right. Exactly. But, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Keith, thank you, man. And again, the book is Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. And Keith Boykin has got himself a real good read here. And I encourage everyone to take up a copy and really get into the meat of what Keith is putting out there about our country, how it's changing, and how there may be more resistance at times to that change than people may appreciate. Until next time, folks, you know what I'm going to tell you. Be safe, be well, get the vaccine, stop being stupid, wear the mask. It's just for a little bit. Come on, we get through this. And we'll see you next time. Take care.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.